From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September with the publication of a new book called The Coddling of the American Mind. The authors argue that, quote, many university students are learning to think in distorted ways, and this increases the likelihood of becoming fragile, anxious, and easily hurt, end quote. Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt are concerned that we have seen radical changes on college campuses in particular. They argue that college students are now demanding protections from basic words and ideas they don't like. And in the end result is going to be a society of hypersensitive, polarized, and people unable to handle adversity. This has sparked fresh debate over whether stereotypes of modern students are fair or whether they're out of line and overblown. And our guests have a lot to say about that. We reached out far and wide, and it was pretty interesting, I have to say, as the host of this program, to hear how many professors want to talk about this but don't think they can talk about this issue from various sides. We do have Amy Guptill, who is a professor of sociology at the College at Brockport. Amy, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Great. Glad to be here.
And Alicia Rios is a junior at the College at Brockport. Alicia, welcome to you.
Hey, thank you.
I also want to say that for those who think that I've either stacked the panel or brought a bias, I promise you I have not, though I did hear from a number of professors who told me that they agree with the authors of the book largely, but if they said so publicly, it could hurt their standing at their various college or university. So they sent some private thoughts. I will read some of those, and I will invite everyone to call the program if you want to call the program this hour. But why don't we start by at least trying to understand the argument that the authors are making, and then we'll have our guests in studio react. So let's listen to some sound if we could. And this is in a recent interview with they've been everywhere, Greg and Jonathan, the authors of this book. This is from CBS and the conversation they had about why they wanted to write the book.
The ancients understood how to thrive, how to get along with people. And so they gave us principles like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But we've somehow begun teaching kids that what doesn't kill them might make them weaker. We need to protect them from words and things like that, which was Greg's original insight. The second great untruth is always trust your feelings. And the third is life is a battle between good people and evil people. I hope we'll be able to talk about here about how these bad ideas got into the educational system, into our child rearing.
All right. So that's Jonathan Haidt. And I want to ask our guests, I'll start with Professor Guptill, what you make of their argument.
Well, it's true that, you know, the ancient university was different and the expectations people brought to it is different. So when we think about what students are looking for out of higher education today, I think it's really important to think about the diverse pathways that lead people to higher ed. I don't see the kind of fragility that the authors have talked about in my classes. I see students who are more often to feel disempowered, to feel marginalized, and to not really hear much from them at all.
When you say you don't really see what the authors are seeing, why do you think they claim to be seeing it on such a wide basis, wide enough to write a book like this then?
I don't really know. I mean, perhaps, I haven't read their book, I have to say, but perhaps they're thinking entirely of the traditional fresh out of high school 18 to 22 year old college population, which, as we know, is a shrinking and now, you know, is less than half of the total student population.
All right. Alicia, let's just start generally speaking, what you make of the arguments that the authors are bringing to their book here.
I feel like their argument is just very, I would say, like, just, I don't feel like they see, I feel like they're very one-sided in a sense. Like, just, I feel like they're not seeing the whole picture. And I feel like a lot of, like, college students, like, like what Dr. Guptill said, like, we just feel like we'll feel disempowered because we feel like there are so many things in the world just in general that are, like, marginalizing us and, like, pushing us to, like, not want to do better. I don't feel like it's more of a matter of, like, we don't want to do things, or we're just lazy, or, like, you know, we're just hurt by things and we just want to change those things. I don't think it's that at all. I think it's we just, like, you know, there are things that I feel like we're just more inclined to want to see change. I feel like our generation is just more, we want to see change. So, like, we're going to push for the things we want to see change about.
What about the idea that there are words or ideas that students are uncomfortable with, and therefore the students are demanding that they not have to encounter those words or ideas? Dr. Guptill, is that, do we ever see that? Or is that a generalization that's unfair?
I think we sure see that. And as a social scientist, as a sociologist, we see that quite a bit. But often what people are pushing back against are things like racism exists and makes a big difference in life chances. And so often when I face hostility, it's about claims like that. And it's not about claims that, you know, people on the left might find objectionable. So we do see some of that. And I think there's a level of healthiness here. Students aren't afraid of professors so much anymore, I think. And I'm glad of that. I embrace it.
Okay, that's a very interesting comment. I want to explore that just a little bit more here, because some of our listeners are probably going to hear that and say, that's good, that students are willing to express themselves, to challenge ideas, to have a dialogue. Others are going to hear that and say, students don't view you as an authority figure, shouldn't they? You're still an authority figure, aren't you, as a professor?
Well, I sure am. I mean, I'm the one that, you know, controls the grade book on a certain basis. And for some students, that can make a big difference, whether they get into the major they're trying to get into or if they're looking towards graduate study. So there's certainly that imbalance of power. And I see that's definitely there.
How do you feel about this? There's a couple of points here. So let's start with the words and ideas. The authors of this book, and again, I'm using Haidt and Lukianoff in their book because they are representing what we often hear from, you know, critics. Sometimes this becomes a right-left issue, not always, and I don't think it has to be a partisan thing. But the critics of the modern college students are saying often what the authors say, which is that when you have an idea or words you don't like, you demand that you don't have to deal with that. Is that fair at all?
I don't think it's fair. But I do, like I said, like I do think that there are people who, like, you know, might see something and like be in. I think we are a little bit more sensitive. Like, I would agree, I guess, with that. Like, but then again, like, that just goes back to, I feel like we as a generation just really want to. We see that, you know, we can make change, and like that we. I feel like we're just. And we see things that we don't like, so we're just like, okay, well, like, I can try to change it. The worst that could happen is that it doesn't change. But, you know, at least I can say I tried. And I feel like even just even like now, like today, like with voting trends, like a lot more young people voted this election, just because I feel like as a generation, we're more inclined to want to push for change. And I don't really see anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I hear that. And so, you know, being a talk show host, you get to hear and understand the views and ideas from a lot of different perspectives. And so from sort of the author's side, I hear them saying everything that you see turns out to be racist or sexist or objectionable. Whereas on the student side, what I hear is we don't tolerate racism or sexism in the way that past generations did. And that's a good thing.
Yes.
And what we are doing is pushing for change on those grounds, not to say if something makes us uncomfortable, we don't want to deal with it. But the world has had a lot of inequality and injustice, and that's not okay anymore.
Exactly. I feel like
I hear both. Go ahead, Alicia.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just saying, like, yeah, like I feel like we just are in a, like I said, like, we are just in this generation where I feel like we are just so, like, we don't tolerate these things. And we know that these things are wrong. And I feel like we're ready to just implement all of that. We're just like, okay, well, this is wrong and this needs to stop. It's been going on for too long. And, like, you know, to say things like, oh, we're just overly sensitive. And, like, to say those things to me seems like it's like, okay, well, like, you're just, like, you're not seeing the bigger picture. And you're not seeing, like, that. It's just we're not standing for that anymore. Just because, like, this is not the way it's been done in the past doesn't mean that it can't, like, you know, we can't change that.
Okay. Dr. Guptill, how do you feel about that sort of the both sides of that argument that I'm hearing, which is what Alicia just articulated versus those who say, yeah, but now they're seeing injustice in everything and they want to shut everything down and it's overbroad?
I think there's a little something to that. Recently, I got to see a great presentation by Dr. Renee Monson, who's a sociologist at Hobart William Smith. And what she argued is that increasingly students are less comfortable with truth claims, an idea that requires evidence and inspires a dialogue, and are much more comfortable with truth statements, the kind of thing you either endorse or simply ignore, like the kind of statements that we process in social media. And so she made the comment that she's seeing students, as she's been tracking them over the years, kind of have a harder and harder time engaging with ideas that challenge deeply held notions. And if students are changing in this way, then that means society is changing in this way.
Okay, so what does that mean for us? I mean, is that a red flag for you? Are you worried about that?
I do worry about that. Okay. I mean, I've often seen a pattern where, for example, I'll explain to an introductory class in sociology that, hey, you know what? When people win the lottery, they very rarely change their lifestyles. Here's the evidence showing that people are very attached to the social circles they're already in or the practices they have, and that those must mean something to people over and above regular comfort. And students will hear me, they'll nod, they'll answer the question correctly on the exam, and then still say something like, but it's just human nature to want as much stuff as you can possibly get. And so there's a sense where they've simply not processed what's been said. But I don't think this is necessarily new. I think in a sense people just feel more empowered to simply reject evidence-driven claims that don't necessarily cohere with their pre-held notions.
Okay, so I have a lot of feedback I want to start working through. And listeners, if you want to call the program with your perspective on, you know, sort of the generalizations about college students and some of the ideas that are being expressed on all sides this hour, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'll give away just a little bit of my own bias because having, you know, hosted this program for going on 5 years now, I have found programs, I go back and I look and I say, I think I overgeneralized here in either assumption or words. Mm-hmm. And I think when we overgeneralize, there is a peril to that. And I hear a lot of overgeneralization about students these days. I also think the older we get, the more we do look back at younger generations and, you know, we have a tendency to say kids these days.
Yeah.
You know, every generation does that. And I think there's a lot to admire about the current generation of college students and current younger adults than me. And mm-hmm. I try to keep reminding myself of that. I also think it's a good idea to try to really limit throwing out or shutting down any speech or conversation, though I'm open to hearing from those who think there are certain ideas that are so dangerous as they don't think they should be tolerated in certain settings or campuses. I'm at least willing to listen to why. So there's a lot to discuss here. I think it's more complex than just college students are this or college students are that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think that's sort of the problem. Do you agree with that, Dr. Guptill?
I definitely agree with that. I think we are looking at the shifting role of higher education in society in general. So, of course, mm-hmm. it makes a difference on multiple scales.
All right. So here are some comments that I've gotten so far, and then I'll start jumping to your phone calls in a moment. Here are three tweets from college professors locally. Mike writes, the stereotypes are exaggerated. Students today are different in both fabulous good ways and in ways that can be frustrating. On the latter, I find a higher percentage struggling with interpersonal skills, a result of too much screen time since early childhood, perhaps. Who's to say? Lawrence writes to us and says, I'll just state here on the record that the negative stereotypes one hears about intolerance and infantilism drive me mad. Using a few high-profile incidents to define a large cohort of college students is a good example of availability bias. That's a great term to keep in mind, availability mm-hmm. bias, because if there is a protest on a campus or if Charles Murray gets injured by a protester, all of a sudden we think, well, every campus shuts mm-hmm. down every speaker. It's not true. Joseph writes to us and says, as a professor, let me just say the stereotypes about modern college students are not true. Older generations always view younger generations with kids these days. Thank you, Joseph, echoing that. And he goes on to write, generations change, but not in the ways that they've been stereotyped. Also problematic is the overuse of millennials, as though they're a mass mm-hmm. monolith. Many are using that term incorrectly. So those are three comments from the, hey, you're overblowing it sort of side of things. But then there's a number of comments on the other side of that argument. We're going to get to that in a moment, but let me get Edward in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Edward.
Hi, Evan. I have a very different way of looking at this. I'd like to add it in. And I think that it sounds similar to a conservative opinion in the title of this book, rather that I'm saying it sounds like the author's idea might be rooted in a conservative way of viewing it. But ultimately, that I want to render this in a, is this a matter of conservative viewpoint versus liberal viewpoint, given that liberals tend to be liberal after their college experience, and we're seeing a lot more people who are well-educated and elite coming out of college with those political attitudes. And the reverse, I think, is true of conservatism. Now, that might be a generalization, but I'm wondering to what degree the idea that elite people with expectations of the world to do what they should, what it should do, given that it's maybe done that for them for a long time, is the source of the resentment that you might see with the idea of treating, you know, millennial college students as snowflakes. The perception that perhaps these people have always had pretty much what they wanted, and why shouldn't they be able to continue to have that? What's with all the complaints? And then to, you know, maybe exemplify a conservative notion of why don't you do it yourself instead of asking for other people to have it done for you?
Mm-hmm. Edward, that's all interesting stuff. And what I want to do, I think that's a great jumping off point to kind of expand the conversation here. So thank you for that. I'm going to kick it to our guests in just a second. But for a little bit of background, I want to do a couple of things. First of all, on the whether it's conservative and liberal sort of frameworks here, the authors themselves have addressed this in various points, and they make the contention that it is not necessarily a right-left or conservative-liberal ideal, and they have pointed to President Trump, largely supported by American conservatives, who just yesterday said he doesn't believe scientists on climate change because in his gut, his feeling is that it's wrong. Well, there's a whole section in the book, The Coddling of the American Mind, about how the authors are concerned that college students are being told to trust their feelings, and that's generally a bad idea, as opposed to trusting evidence, calmness, reason. But they also point to the president as someone who constantly says he doesn't care about the evidence, he trusts his feelings, and also someone who doesn't like dissent. Well, the president clearly doesn't like dissent, and the authors are saying modern college students don't like dissenting ideas either. So at least there's on the national political scene something that kind of pushes against that in some way, Edward. But I think the larger point's an interesting question, and it's fair. I also want to point out that the authors are explicitly claiming in various places that they don't necessarily blame college students, even though they're concerned about what college students are becoming as adults, because they blame their parents and professors and others for coddling them, for taking the what is a largely wealthy society and making life way too easy for college students, never challenging them, always giving them a higher grade than they deserve, not pushing back, not telling them they're wrong. And so the authors say the real sort of villains here are the older generation. And so the college students are going to be hobbled by this. Anyway, that's a little bit of the framework. Let me ask our guests to kind of weigh in on what they heard. First, what you heard from Edward and how he views, whether it may be rooted in conservatism and liberalism.
Well, I'm not sure about conservatism and liberalism per se, but like Edward, I see a lot of hostility towards higher ed in general. And I think a lot of it has to do with this somewhat enraging notion that a bachelor's degree is somehow compulsory, yet the payoff is completely uncertain. Mm-hmm. So if you're a parent and you are looking at some serious debt, and you're also looking at your beloved child entering a world that you don't know much about, and you've got, you know, very little to go on to help guide your child through this experience, then yeah, your dander's going to be up and you're going to have a lot of thoughts and feelings about what's going on there. So I think there's a lot to be said about we don't have a shared vision of what higher ed is supposed to do for our society, and that sets the stage for this kind of hostility and this kind of resentment.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Dr. Guptill. She, and what she's saying, like, about, you know, the older generation just, like, not really knowing, like, college is, or, like, what college is supposed to be like, or, like, what a bachelor's is, like, the meaning, like, what the payoff of a bachelor's is, or something like that. Like, I know for me, like, being a first-generation college student, my mom and, like, my family, like, I don't have, like, a line of people who went to college. So it's kind of like, they want me to go to college. Like, they do want me to do that, but, like, not every family has that view. Like, some people would say, like, okay, like, maybe you should just work, because, like, that is a set, for, like, you know what you're going to get out of that. If you go to college, you get a bachelor's degree, you spend all this money, who's to say that you're going to, you know, come out on top? But I do, like I said, I agree that there's a lot of hostility toward higher education in general. But I don't, I don't really think that it's like a liberal versus conservative kind of thing, because I think that someone can be on the left but still have like a hostility toward like higher education in general, just to say like maybe this is not worth it. Like, because there are a lot of people who say like maybe college isn't worth it and stuff like that.
Rolf writes to us, so let's start digesting some of the pushback here. Rolf writes and says, the most important consequence for college students today is that graduates are unable to construct arguments. When they are not required to deal with intellectual adversity in college, they never learn to do this in real life. And that will lead to a society where no middle ground exists and neither side of an issue is willing or able to discuss it with one another. Strong words from Rolf. All right, Dr. Guptill, what do you think?
A little overstated, but certainly pointing to issues. And I think, but here again, I would look at the broader social context. A lot of us have trouble grappling with arguments, with complex arguments that are not black and white, for example. And I think higher education does have a major role to play in equipping more and more people to be able to do that. Are we doing that to the best of our ability? Maybe not. Maybe there's more we can do. Maybe there's more ways we can empower faculty and empower students to engage with difficult ideas in a way that's not, you know, marginalizing, that's not humiliating. And often I think it's students on the conservative end of the realm that are likely to feel marginalized or in that realm. So I think there's more we can do to address the kind of problem that Rolf is pointing to. I don't think we're on, you know, last train to Doomtown in quite the way that was expressed. But I think he's pointing to a real need and a real need that higher ed can fulfill.
But a real need, and I applaud you for pointing this out here, for everybody. Because Rolf's framework there is that somehow all these previous generations are really good at just considering, having these, you know, I employ the Socratic method every day of my life.
Yeah.
And I love when my mind changes and I love when evidence moves me off an opinion. I mean, I had a conversation with adults much older than college students about a year ago who said, oh, your job must be so interesting. You encounter all these interesting ideas. Do you change your mind a lot? And I said, personally, yes. As the host of the program, my views generally are not really relevant. Mm-hmm. But privately, I do find my mind changing a lot on this program in very different directions. And they were all sitting there going, I can't remember the last time I changed my mind about a big issue. These were adults in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Can't remember the last time. So the notion that Rolf brings, I think, is a little unfair, that only the college student generation, boy, they're going to be the ones hobbled because they're not good at having their minds open. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Guptill.
Well, some of the people that share Rolf's concerns point to standardized testing as being corrosive to one's ability to think for yourself, you know, and sometimes if we feel like, you know, as professors, if we feel like students are approaching us with the attitude of just tell me what you want me to say and I'll say it and I'll get my grade and we'll all move on with our lives, they point to standardized testing. Like, this is the generation of No Child Left Behind now entering our classrooms. That, too, I think might be overstated. I see the kind of work students are doing and our, you know, our colleagues at the high school level and before are creative, engaging instructors for the most part, and they're doing what they can to really help students think. And so I'm not a huge fan of the standardized testing regime myself, and I think that might play a role. Mm-hmm. But I think that's another area where people think we're perhaps doing students wrong.
Okay, and I'll turn it over to Alicia. I will say I might have sounded a little bit of talking down from the mountaintop there. My mind does change a lot on this program, and that's a great pleasure of it. But I will also be very honest. There are times where I look back and I think, boy, I can't believe I was so dogmatic. Or, I mean, I'm like anybody else, I think. And I think we can all do better. So to Rolf's email, where I think Rolf is on the money, is that it matters that we have a society of people who are willing to be open to evidence, willing to change their mind, willing to engage, not just to shout at people, but to listen and absorb feedback.
Yeah.
And maybe Rolf is concerned that we're all not very good, but college students are especially bad. I don't know. How do you feel about that, Alicia?
I think that's, like, I know for me, like, yes, it's hard to say, to want to change your mind or, like, to have somebody just come in and totally destroy every idea you've ever had.
Yes.
I think, like, but, like, that happens to me a lot, just, like, you know, with the people I'm around, because, like, but I find it, like, stimulating, like, okay, like, and just just to listen to other people, the ability to do it. I don't think that college students are, like, incapable of doing it. But I think, like, it's just, I think it's a people thing. I don't think it's just, like, college students. I don't think just college students don't take others' ideas well. I don't think anybody likes to have their idea, like, that done to them. So I think it is, like, a huge, like, overstep to say, like, oh, well, this is college students. But with standardized testing, like, I do know, like, in high school, like, I did feel like kind of like they just taught you how to take they teach you how to take tests and how to pass. I do agree that, like, maybe they don't go into, like, I don't really like standardized testing, just in the fact that, like, I feel like it, like I said, it doesn't really teach you. I don't feel like it doesn't teach me to expand. Like, I don't feel like I learn the information. I feel like I learn the answers. Like, I learn, like, what to say, like, if that makes sense. Like, I learn what to say and how to pass, and, like, I just forget about it. Like, I don't really remember much about what I learned in high school. Yeah.
But and so, Alicia, an extension of the point that Rolf is making mm-hmm. that I hear often sounds something like this. College students today already think they know everything. And that's why they're there to shout at you instead of engage with you. Fair or unfair?
Unfair. That is so unfair. I don't think that we think we know everything. I think that we have opinions, and everybody has an opinion. I don't feel like that's new. Like, something special to college students. Everybody has an opinion about what they think, and sometimes it's hard. Like, and a lot of it, I think, is, like, just culturally. Like, you know, if your mom taught you how, like, all right, well, like, this is, like, a random topic, but cleaning your meat, cleaning chicken, like, that in, like, my house, like, you have to clean your meat. But, like, science says it's not, like, all you have to do is heat it up, and, like, in the, like, if you heat it, it'll burn the bacteria, it'll be fine. Like, and you, like, cook it, it's fine. But, like, you know, that's a cultural thing, like, I learned that in my house. Well, I think that that's the right way. That's the right way, and that's just how I'm going to do it. But, but, like, I can't argue with science, but I just think that's, like, a lot of it goes back to, like, cultural, like, you know, like, what you learn, it's kind of hard to deviate from mm-hmm. what we learn.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Guptill?
I read a really interesting idea in a higher education journal. I think it's called Thought in Action. And it's the notion has to do with the emotional experience of learning. Because at the moment you're learning something new, you're in a sense unlearning. You're letting go of one set of shortcuts in order to adopt a new way of looking at some criteria, new way of looking at the world. And when you do that, you are in the moment, by definition, incompetent. And it sucks to feel incompetent,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like, that is
nobody wants
feeling.
To feel incompetent. So there's an emotional cost to learning. And sometimes I think I see a lot of students with their caregiving responsibilities, with their work responsibilities, and a full-time course load on top of that, that they do have limited time and also limited emotional bandwidth. And mm-hmm. they make their choices about how to invest it. And
yeah.
And that is totally up to them how to make yeah. those choices, and I respect that. So I think if we think, oh, people don't want to change their minds. Well, if changing your mind means learning, changing your mind means feeling incompetent for a while. And yeah. so as a sociologist, I can't bring myself to say, well, it's human nature. But
yeah.
but it costs you something.
It does.
Okay, and so more of the feedback that we're getting that's coming in fast and furious now. Well, a lot of it fast, not all of it's furious.
Okay.
A little furious.
Oh, goodness.
Kathy writes to us and says, as a parent who has coddled and helicoptered their child, I feel a lot of this falls on the shoulders of those of us who have tried to do everything for their children. I have learned from experience that the more I try to do for my college student, the higher their anxiety. If I had any advice for parents now, I would say, let them fail. Let them make mistakes. Don't try to clean up every mess and control what happens to them. And do this from an early age. Let them develop competence so that they are ready to be adults before they go to college. The business mm-hmm. of college is as much about becoming an adult as it is about learning. What do you make of that?
I totally agree with her. I do agree. I agree with, like, just, like, that whole notion just of, like, you know, not coddling them, letting people fail. And, like, college is about learning how to be an adult and learning how to, like, do things for yourself and not be so it's about like detaching yourself from your parents, like, and detaching yourself from like that dependency you have on your parents. Like, yes, your parents, like, or, you know, your primary caregiver is always going to like be like your base, like the person that you just always like go back to, like, you can fall, like you can count on them. But like, you do have to learn how to detach yourself from them so that you can learn to be competent and like to do things for yourself. So like, paying rent is something that was new for me this semester and like paying bills, like, and that's, and I felt like an adult. I really do feel like an adult. And my mom, like, she didn't help me do it. Like, she told me what to do, but like, she didn't like guide, like, she doesn't do it for me. And like, she lets me do it. Like, I have to remember to pay my bills, and I have to remember that I have to like go grocery shopping and things like that. So, there are like so many different components, but like, even like with going to class, like, I have to remember that I have to go to class. Like, and it, a big part of college is learning how to be independent. And I do think that parents should definitely like let their kids like fail and learn. Like, because I feel like a lot of like experiencing is learning. And like, when you experience things, like, you learn from them. So like, if I miss my class and I fail my class, maybe I should start going to class. And like, that's like a lesson for me.
Okay, Professor Guptill, what would you say to this idea that that sometimes parents are unwilling to let their children fail?
I think that definitely happens. But what also jumps to my mind is that the typical college student, numerically speaking, isn't the 18 to 22-year-old. Mm-hmm. It's community college students.
Adult learners.
Or transfers or adult mm-hmm. learners. Like, there's a lot of pathways through higher ed. And so those folks are anything but coddled by anybody for the most part. Those are people where you have to, like, if they miss a paper deadline, you have to get in touch with them and mm-hmm. tell them that they can still submit, because it doesn't occur to them that that's a privilege that they have. So, but when I do think about people who are fresh out of high school, which is still, you know, a huge part of the college population, yeah, there is some of that. And sometimes, you know, the parents who are really trying to help are the parents who aren't quite sure how to navigate, or sometimes they expect college to be like it was for them when they went to college, and mm-hmm. things are real, real different in a lot of different ways.
Well, I will just say, it is hard to watch your children struggle or suffer in any way. Mm-hmm. As a parent myself, and the more privileged we are, and I'm someone of enormous privilege, the more you can afford to find ways when you raise your children for them to really not fail much, or at least that could be your perception, mm-hmm. for them to avoid pain or losing in different ways. And it takes some real work to convince yourself to let them do that.
Yeah.
So, Kathy, thank you for that email. That was great stuff.
Yes.
I'm late for our only break here. Alicia Rios is a junior at the College of Brockport, and Amy Guptill is a professor of sociology there. We're having a conversation this hour about whether these stereotypes of modern college students are fair or overblown, and how to really understand this conversation that sometimes gets so polarized or just kind of oversimplified. It's a conversation that a lot of people are having after the publication a couple of months ago, a new book called The Coddling of the American Mind, in which the authors are arguing that mostly college students, but really young American adults, are not very good at engaging with the world, and it's because they have been coddled too much, that they don't like dissent, that they think they're always right. So we're having a conversation about that and a lot more. I'm going to read a couple more notes from college professors on the other side of this break, and if you want to weigh in, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, for the first time ever, scientists have observed an object coming into our solar system from a neighboring solar system. It's a big deal. And some scientists from Harvard are now speculating that maybe this thing is an alien spacecraft after all. What is it? What do we know about it? How can we track it? And what are the ethics of trying to talk to it? That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the subject of letting students fail, Hal in Avon is next. Go ahead, Hal.
Hello?
Go ahead, Hal.
Oh, okay. hi. Well, I've had a variety of academic degrees, bachelor's, master's, PhD, postdocs, and the like.
Uh-oh, Hal. I hope you will call us back and that you're not driving and that you are safe, because we lost you, Hal. So please call us back, and we'll continue that thought. And what I'll do now is I'm going to read a couple of comments that came in via email from college professors who were not able to join us, and I will read their remarks in full. Here's one from a local college professor who aired some concern that if he came on a program like this, that there might be some backlash for saying these kinds of things, but I'll read his private remarks. Quote, let me preface this by saying there are a lot of really good students, but there has been a trend over the last 10 years about how things are done, which I don't think is right, though I might be old-fashioned in that regard. A couple of examples would be things like the university providing accommodations to students for tests, quizzes, projects. I certainly understand that there are students who need some of these due to learning disabilities, etc., but I have a hard time accepting that any student would need 3 times extra for an exam, and that does not translate well into the real world. Evan, would you be able to go to your boss and say, I know I've got to do a radio show in 2 hours, but I need 6 more hours to prepare for it? The university isn't doing any favors to students in that regard. There was an article not long ago about a teacher in high school who got fired for handing out zeros for work not turned in instead of the 50s that her school mandated. It is policies like this that are setting kids up to not experience failure and always have a way to recover from bad choices and decisions that they make. Many of this generation always have someone else to solve their problems and aren't willing to take personal responsibility to solve their own problems. I once caught 6 grad students cheating on an exam, and I failed them for the course. And they spent the next week badgering me, saying that I was ruining their future. End quote. Dr. Guptill, what would you say to this professor?
Well, I, like that professor, I struggle with the notion that, you know, my students are in my class now, and in a number of years, they're going to be out in the careers. And I struggle with the notion that, yeah, you know, the working world is hostile to people with disabilities. You had an excellent show here, gosh, a month ago or so ago, where J.D. Flotis, who I wonderfully got to work with at Brockport, really explained some of that. And so, but I got to say, as an instructor, my role is to help people learn. And I want people to have ample time on the exam to, you know, show me what they know. And if they need longer to process the language of the exam in order to show me what they know, that's not really an advantage. Like that writer, I've seen trends where sometimes I'm being required to consider accommodations that strike me as either unfair or counter to the spirit of the actual learning work we're trying to do. And I don't think we have necessarily a coherent vision in higher ed about how best to help students with disabilities, various kinds of disabilities, either learning disabilities or perhaps mood disorders that people are working with, to succeed both in higher ed and beyond. So sometimes that, you know, you're presented with something as an instructor that strikes you as either unfair or somehow inappropriate. But it always helps me to remember the larger context that sets the stage for that kind of issue.
Okay. Alicia?
I don't know. I kind of understand it sounds like to me what he's talking about, like, is he wants students to have accountability. Like, he wants us to be held accountable for, like, you know, our mistakes. And it seems like, you know, we're trying, I guess, like, as a society, we're trying to, like coddle them, I guess, and, like, say, like, oh, no, it's okay. With the whole, like, testing thing, I don't know. I think that in the real world, I'm not going to be sitting down for, like, a 4-hour test on, like, on, like, a class that I learned. So I feel like there's nothing wrong with giving, like, extra time for tests. And especially, like, we also, like Dr. Guptill was saying about learning disabilities and stuff like that, people do need extra time. Like, there's, like, and I don't feel like
get right on your microphone.
Oh,
okay. That's
sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, and like people do need extra time, and I think, like, as a society, we don't really know how to aid those people, like, especially in the real world. And I think the real world is pretty hostile, and I think that maybe he is on to something, like, about, like, saying maybe, like, there are some things that are overstretched. But I don't think one case scenario of, like, a teacher getting fired because of this, or, like, not to say that there aren't others, but I don't think there are that many instances where, like, we're overly doing that to say, like, yeah.
Sure. And Professor Guptill, if you caught 6 students cheating, you would fail them, I assume.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And your school would back you up on that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And do you expect that the students would complain about that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. I mean, especially if it's a high stakes thing. And sometimes complaining gets you what you want. And I mean, for our students navigate all sorts of bureaucracies in their lives. And sometimes being the squeaky wheel is the thing that gets you, mm-hmm. you know, what you need. And so if being the squeaky wheel in this case, and you know, and in this case, you know, you can squeak away, but the grade stands.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of consequences for, especially for bad behavior.
Yeah.
But and to this professor, I would say I'm glad he shared his thoughts, and I wish he were here. But the notion again that there's something special about this generation of students not accepting failure. How many CEOs went to jail on Wall Street? How many people who ran banks into the ground and did all kinds of awful and probably illegal things are still sitting there in million-dollar mansions? Our country is not all that good at holding people accountable when they do wrong, especially if they are in positions of power and privilege.
Yeah.
And I think everyone should be held accountable when they do wrong. I think if you cheat on a college exam, you got to be failed.
Yeah.
And if you want to complain, too bad. But it's not unique to this generation that they seek to avoid consequences. So I'm not sure that's a... I wish you were here, and I'm really glad you shared that. Another professor, this one from the Midwest, and I can't say more, unfortunately, but I have vetted this professor, just writes the following. He says, Evan, I have grad students, and the American ones are generally unbearable, entitled, presumptuous, hypersensitive, and surprisingly uninformed about policy and current affairs for people whose professions are so affected by them. They are so spoiled. They freak out if they have less than a week notice to read one article. So being what I thought was a good professor by sending relevant, fresh pieces is not only unhelpful to them, but disdained. They get angry with me for sending them extra material that I think could help. Okay, that's a professor in the Midwest. Professor Guptill, those are some strong words as well. What would you say to him?
One sort of bitter joke that some professors make is college is something that people pay the most for, yet somehow want the least of. For example, if class gets canceled, everybody's like, woohoo, when really, you know,
that's
you
a great
paid for
point.
That.
Yeah. Such a good point.
And I think sometimes, too, I've heard students say earnestly, you know, my professors don't understand. I leave campus and then I go home and I do all this caregiving for people in my life and then I go to work and I don't have time to read this 20-page article. And that tells me that there's a really important disconnect between expectations and reality in terms of what it takes to really learn. So I don't know what has set the stage for the kind of frustration that the professor you just quoted has encountered. I certainly believe that narrative. I think it's plausible. I think it happens. I'm sure some of my colleagues in this area would have had similar experiences. But yeah, there's a broader context there, and I don't think whatever set the stage is necessarily, you know, the coddling of the American mind.
Okay. And if you send extra reading materials to your students, do they push back and say, "Why'd you do that?" Or do they say, "Hey, thanks, that's helpful"?
Probably neither. I mean, you know, I only teach undergraduates, right? So they've got 5 courses. So they go, "Oh, hey, what do you know?" And then they move on to their next deadline.
Okay. Alicia, you want to add to what the professor had to say there?
Okay. I feel like he's dragging it. I don't know. I think that, well, in the terms of like giving them giving something to read and they need a week's notice, I mean, I would like to be prepared because like there's a lot of other things going on, and I feel like that's just about professionalism. And if you think, I feel like if that's the case, then make it optional, like to read. If it's something that you just think that would help, and then you're gonna give it like such a late notice, then at least like tell me it's optional. But I do kind of see what he's saying. Like I see the point that he's trying to make, but again, I think it's just like, I feel like it's an overgeneralization to say like it's just us Americans and we are just spoiled and we are entitled, when really I just think it's just about like us, we just want to advocate for ourselves. So, and I don't really think much anyone gets hurt by it, because you have the choice to either say yeah, you can't, like to either say like yes or no, like yes, like you have to read it or whatever it is, like but I don't feel like there's any problem with wanting to advocate for yourself. Like, okay, yeah, I think something is wrong, so I feel like I should advocate for myself.
Yeah. And so, Professor Guptill, in listening to Alicia's experiences and talking about advocacy from a student perspective, one thing that I would observe is that if we agree that we've had an unequal society, that we've had a society that has spent decades, our entire existence, operating with injustice, an advantage for some and disadvantage for others, and persecution for some and not for others. If we agree with that, and I don't know how anybody would disagree with that, then the remedies for that are never going to be perfectly snug and clean. We don't get to, you know, have a moment where, well, your advocacy is perfectly appropriate and it doesn't overstep one bit.
Yeah.
In other words, if students are pushing for change, we should expect that there are going to be moments where, hey, I understand why you wanted to shut this down, but then you shut this down over here, and that was probably a bridge too far. Yeah. Or we can agree or disagree on that. But the notion that if they do that occasionally, that it's somehow indicative of a spoiled generation, as opposed to the messy sort of recalibration of justice, I think is a little unfair. I mean, we nothing is perfectly snug and clean when you're trying to sort of rebalance your view of justice in a society. Is that fair?
I think so. And thinking institutionally, I mean, higher education 100 years ago was where the children of the elite, primarily the sons of the elite, went to, you know, learn Latin and play football and whatever, you know. And now, certainly, here we are a generation past the GI Bill. And I don't think we're necessarily clear on what it is. You can't just open the doors, invite all these new people in, and expect the institution to remain the same. The institution of higher ed needs to evolve to reflect the needs it serves and its realities. And I think, you know, the frustrations that people are expressing are totally legitimate. They happen. They impede our work as educators and as learners. And they're not the kinds of things we want, for sure. But I think thinking big picture about the changing role of higher ed really helps explain where those things come from.
And that's why I go back to the generalizations, which I think I'm guilty of too often. I have no problem looking incident by incident on college campuses. Was this appropriate? Was this not? And there are times where I go, wow, I can't believe they shut this down, or this was an overreach, or this was sort of anti-free speech. And I think that that's okay. But then taking that and extrapolating, well, all college students today are X, to me is totally unproductive and unfair, and really doesn't serve anything but maybe selling a few books, maybe. But that's why we're having these kind of conversations. Let me try to get Hal back, who's back on the phone. Hope you're okay, Hal. Thanks again. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry. Yes, I very much agree with years of experience with the discussion, with one exception. The role of visitors, adjunct professors, and assistant professors is a very different one than a tenure. In other words, they're evaluated on giving privilege to the privileged American students, and that because they are on a contract either by semester or year, they're in a very different situation than tenured professors, and that's increased tremendously over the years. In other words, they aren't paid well. In 30 years, I was getting paid the same thing in New York State, for example, for a semester course. So this has a way of dumbing down everything and allowing people to get by that should be given a C or less as a grade. So that's my two cents. Thank you very much.
Okay, Hal, thank you. Professor Guptill?
I think Hal is exactly right that the, you know, what they people have called the adjunctification, the increasing reliance on adjunct instructors for a really small contractual price, has a real corrosive effect on the academy. And I think he's right that not only is the pay lousy, but sometimes a lot of these instructors, these, you know, talented, committed instructors, don't even have an office to sit in, don't even have a place to meet with students when they need to. So that's going to impede things as well. So, and then the pressure on them, semester by semester by semester, is tremendous. And, you know, I'm currently serving as a department chair, so I can do, you know, as an individual, I can make clear to people who are on an adjunct appointment in my department, you know, you do you. You're the instructor. I'm on your side. And but that's not going to be the case. And that can shift, you know, semester to semester as people cycle in and out of these roles.
And let me just ask Alicia a question. It comes from James, who says, Evan, great show. Thanks for the program today. Can you ask the student on your panel, is there anything that she thinks should not be allowed to be said or people who should not be allowed to present on campus?
Pressure. I don't know. I think that there are things that shouldn't be said, things that are hostile, things that are bigoted, or things that are just like plain and outright disrespectful. I think that those things shouldn't be said on campuses. And I'm not sure if those violate free speech laws. But I mean, I think that as we make our campuses, a lot more campuses are getting, you know, more diverse and more, like, there's so much more people, like, than just one, it's more than just one type of person who's attending colleges. Who and because of that, like, campuses, like, the culture of the campus needs to change and to in order to accommodate for the growing diversity. And so, yes, I do think that there are things that should not be said. There are people who should not be allowed to come in and, like, completely, like, you know, just say things that are not respectful to the people who inhabit the campus and stuff like that.
Okay, Professor Guptill, do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think of it in terms of, like, things that shouldn't be said per se, because if people are sitting around talking and they say things that I would classify as hate speech, then the speech clearly only applies to them. But it's when an institution is spending its resources, sometimes those resources around the realm of security, to host a speaker who advocates kind of a hateful position. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's inappropriate for an institution to spend its resources on that. But I mean, I can't see installing, you know, Google Home devices listening for certain trigger words meant mm-hmm. to police people's private speech, in a sense, or people's individual speech. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think of it as things that shouldn't be said, but mm-hmm. rather, what is the institution going to stand up for?
Yeah. Well, I know we're going to continue to talk about this. And to answer another email, someone just said, Evan, there's no incidents on college campuses that you think went too far? Of course there are. I can point to lots of them around the country where I say, oh boy, this one got out of hand, or I think this is overboard. Absolutely. But I try not to generalize, and I think that's one of the lessons I'm taking from this, that this stuff is complex. Students are complex. The generations are complex. And I want to thank Alicia Rios, a junior at the College of Brockport, for sharing her hour with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Professor Amy Guptill, professor of sociology at the College of Brockport. Thank you to you as well.
Thanks to you.
Our thanks to also the professors who took time to write in. But I hope that in the future, let's sit down together. Let's continue the conversation. Let's not shout down these conversations. Let's keep having them. More connections coming up.